This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Marxist economist Professor Rick Wolf and with National Lawyers Guild attorney Eric Poulos on the economic and social crisis that's unfolding in Greece. The biggest social and political explosion since May-June of 1968 in France has occurred in Greece, and it very well may spread here. Jim Lafferty is a longtime leader of the National Lawyers Guild and the organizer of the Guild chapter in Los Angeles. He recently returned from a trip to Arizona, and he's also in the midst of organizing the National Anti-War Conference in Albany, New York, scheduled for this July. We get those updates from Jim Lafferty. Stay with us. Today, we are joined in the studio by Professor of Economics Rick Wolf and New York City National Lawyers Guild attorney Eric Poulos to speak about the crisis in Greece and its ramifications throughout Europe and indeed in the United States. The economic collapse in Greece might well be replicated here in the United States because of excessive government borrowing and the inability of the government to tax rich people. They borrow instead, and a crisis ensues. It was covered over by the Greek government with the aid of bankers, including Goldman Sachs. It's being covered over here in the United States. The amount of debt in the United States is just as severe as it was in Greece. Rick Wolf is recently back from a trip to Greece. Eric Poulos organized a fine panel on the crisis in Greece at the Breck Forum last month. Eric has family in Greece and is a frequent visitor to Greece, follows the political situation there closely. Rick is one of the premier Marxist economists in the United States. Listen closely, because what they have to say about Greece is very relevant to what's going on in the United States. Rick Wolf, Eric Poulos, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having us.
Rick and Eric, you've been to Greece. Rick, you just got back. You've been following the economics and the social explosion very closely. I think that this is probably the most important thing that's going on, along with the wars the United States is carrying on. But what's going on in Greece, which seems to be spreading and may even spread here, is something that's extremely important for our listeners to get a handle on. Rick, how did the economic disaster in Greece develop?
Well, let me start by describing last week, the last week of May, when I was in Athens and gave talks at the university and, of course, talked with my hosts who are professors there. And I looked at their faces and I realized that the economic crisis that we talk about had come home to hit them very hard. Every single professor in the public universities of Greece, and that's what most universities there are, received a pay cut, which took effect the week I arrived, 15 to 20% less money per year for every teacher in the country. And not only every teacher, but every public employee. And I mean every. It includes the police and the foot soldiers in the army. Everybody took a 15 to 20% cut, and the government announced more cuts coming in October and November of this year. So you see then an economic crisis that everybody talks about, but on top of the unemployment in Greece, this is a blow against every single working person, every single public employee, and the public sector in Greece is very large. So you're going to have a ramifying effect. All these people will have much less money to spend. That means that private employers and private businesses will have less business, less customers. They will lay off workers. Those workers will also press down the wages in the private sector because they have to compete. So you have a situation of a major disaster that is spreading, and we're only at the beginning of it. And what is happening in Greece is threatened for other European countries. Spain, Portugal, Italy, Ireland are major ones that everybody knows are on the list. But the real question is, how much further? And also, is this the future of the United States as well? So I think Greece is, as you say, Michael, right in the center of the storm of this economic crisis that keeps exploding here, there, in new ways. This crisis is showing us that we are in for years of the fundamental dysfunction of capitalism as a global system.
Eric, you've been following the social struggles that have erupted in Greece very closely. The general strikes they've had there are a phenomena that we haven't seen in the world since May, June in France of 1968, when the very existence of French capitalism was threatened. Talk to us about what's happened in Greece since the threatened bankruptcy.
Well, Greece is really a society that is smoldering. Which way it goes is still up for grabs. We don't know. But there have been at least seven general strikes just since the announced cutbacks in March, which is unprecedented to have seven general strikes like that. There have been strikes in all sectors. And as Rick points out, much of Greece, much of the workforce is the public sector. So when the civil servants go on strike, that's a huge percentage of the workforce. It's a crisis that's been building, not just economically, but even within Greek society, a society that has changed rapidly and in very, very extreme ways, so that Greece, which 20 years ago was about the most homogeneous society on the face of the earth, now has over 10% of its residents recent immigrants. There was a huge outpouring a year and a half ago when a young person was shot by the police. Practically every college campus, every high school, even immigrant youths took to the street. Symbolic Christmas tree in downtown Athens was burned to the ground, and the police are who did the shooting are right now being tried as we speak, and they have to be escorted to court every day by armed guards because the anger is such. So there's a big resentment brewing. The working class is the youth unemployment figures are 25%. Greece is losing the same amount of jobs as the U.S. 40,000 jobs a month are being lost in Greece. Greece is 10 million people. Imagine if the same amount of jobs are being lost in a society that's 10 million compared to 300 million in the United States. So it's a real crisis situation. The situation Rick talked about, cutbacks in pay, also civil servants have not been able to get their prescriptions filled since March because the government organization that reimburses pharmacies is out of money. So civil servants in 3 months haven't been able to get prescriptions. It's really a crisis situation. What might be particularly interesting for the listeners of your radio station is that this is being done by a prime minister who's head of the Socialist International, George Papandreou. And it's a government that calls itself socialist. Two-thirds of members of parliament call themselves either socialists or communists. So it's a country where the socialists came to power on a platform of anti-cutbacks, where the socialists in name have run the country pretty much for the last 30 to 36 years. And yet this is what's in store for the working class in Greece.
Rick, explain to us in a nutshell, if that's possible, how the Greek economy got into the jam that it's in.
I'd be glad to, and I'll try to do it in a way that will show your listeners that the problems of Greece are the same problems everywhere. The attempt to make Greek society out to be bizarre, unusual, special, and therefore to isolate the crisis there by making believe it doesn't have the same roots everywhere else is what I'm kind of tilt against here. Greece is remarkable in one way. It has a well-organized, strong working class. It has powerful trade unions. It has strong socialist and communist parties. And it has a long tradition of worker militancy. And that's important for the following reason. You can't treat workers in Greece the way you can in a number of other countries. And over the years, governments, one after the other in Greece, have confronted that reality in the following way. There's a very powerful and rich business community in Greece, and they want the government to do what they want. And that means they don't want to have to pay taxes, and they are notorious tax evaders. And they want the government to serve their needs, the needs of business. But the working class also approaches the government and basically says the same thing. We don't want to pay the taxes either, and we want you to do things for us, to provide a health program, to provide an educational program. This is an impossible situation. And the working class is powerful enough, unlike here in the United States, to make the government sit up and take notice. How does a government function if the business community doesn't want to pay taxes and evades them? That the working class resists ever more taxes, so you can't just shift it on them, and both sides want the government to take care of them. The solution for the Greek government, as for most other governments, including the United States, is that the government avoids the trouble, placates both sides, if you like, the employers and the employees, by not taxing either of them as much as would be necessary to provide the services both of them want. And how do they do that? By borrowing. The solution of all governments in this jam, they borrow the money. That's a substitute for taxing people who don't want to be taxed. And it's a way of raising the money to provide what both employers and employees want, especially in a country where the employees can make their power felt. So Greece has been borrowing money, as have most other governments. And there's been no problem about that. That's been the way capitalism resolves its absurd struggles between workers and employers, by borrowing and borrowing and borrowing, and it kept going. This was working fine, been lasting for years, until the great capitalist crisis of the last 3 years. Then something happened that changed everything. The United States' economic system collapsed. And the only way to bail it out here in the United States was for first the Bush administration and now the Obama administration to borrow more money to try to fix the American economy than the United States had ever borrowed in peacetime before. And suddenly, in the world of money lending to the government, the richest and most powerful government was borrowing every cent it could find across the globe. That meant that lenders faced a new situation. If you're a lender, including a Greek bank or a German bank or a rich person in Norway or whatever, you now have the whole world's governments begging for money to bail themselves out of a capitalist crisis. But most important, you have the richest, most powerful one, the United States, borrowing every nickel. At that point, people who lend money to governments said to themselves, as you understand the logic of it, why should I lend to a little embattled country like Greece or Portugal or even troubled countries like Spain and Italy? I can lend all the money I want to a much more secure government, equipped with the biggest nuclear arsenal in the world, committed to capitalism in a way none of those other countries are. And so what happened was Greece suddenly discovered that the people it normally turned to borrow, as it had been doing for 25 years, announced to the Greek government, no, thank you. We don't need to lend to you. We're going to lend to the United States, which is a better bet, a surer bet. And, well, we'll lend to you maybe, but only if you pay us much more interest and you take all kinds of steps to make yourself less risky by squeezing your population, spend less on the people so you have more money to hold back in security for us as your creditors. And so the way it worked was, it's ironic, but it's the American crisis that created the dilemma for Greece. Suddenly the Greek government discovered to borrow money the way they had always done was going to cost them a fortune more, then it was going to be too hard. Then it wouldn't be possible anymore to pay off the creditors at these high interest rates that they were demanding without really squeezing their people. So what they began to do was to threaten what all debtors threaten when things get impossible. Default. We won't pay. And it's important for your listeners to understand, this happens all the time. It was only 5 years ago that an enormous, much bigger country than Greece, namely Argentina, defaulted on its debt. It got out of a huge portion of its debt, about half of it, by simply saying, you're never going to get paid to its creditors. And guess what? Creditors know that. Creditors know when you lend to a government, it may get into trouble. It happens all the time. And so the people who lent to Greece, they understood perfectly well what they were doing. And they made sure they got fees and they got nice interest rates. They've made their money. They can live with it. They have the resources. Just as they got through it in Argentina, they could get through it in Greece. But the problem was they didn't want to. The biggest holders of the debt of Greece are French and German banks, as it happens in the world. Greek banks, but also French and German banks. They didn't want to lose that money. And so they turned to the Greek government and they turned to the European government and said, squeeze them, but don't squeeze them to the point where they'll default. And so that's the deal. The European Central Bank came in, bailed out Greece, that is, promised Greece that they would lend them the money they need at an interest rate that is not as high as what the private lenders were demanding. So it gets Greece out of the immediate problem. But the European Central Bank did exactly what the private creditors did. It said, we'll help you this time, but we want you to change Greece so that you become less of a risk and that you really can pay this money back. So we want to see you cut back the money you use to take care of people in your country and make that money available to retire, to pay back your debt and to lower your debt. So that's the, quote, solution. And as Eric says, it's only remarkable for two reasons. One, as Eric said, that it's a socialist government led by George Papandreou, and I might mention, your listeners might enjoy it, that he took a course in economics from me. He was a student at Amherst College. Amherst College students can go to the University of Massachusetts.
What grade did he get?
I don't remember, frankly, but he came and introduced himself. I remember it years ago, and together with several other Greek students, and they sat in my class because it was a kind of economics they couldn't get at Amherst College. I take no responsibility for what he's doing, but it is remarkable, as Eric said.
We're not holding him responsible.
That a socialist,
okay.
A socialist government would make cut such a deal and savage its people. But even more interesting than that, I think, is this. The same banks, major banks in Europe and the rest of the world, whose irresponsible, risky behavior was a major contributor to the global crisis, are now using that crisis to squeeze working classes around the world, starting really by happenstance in Greece, could have happened somewhere else, in order to get the world economy to be more focused on their needs. The people who brought us the crisis are dictating the suffering of masses of people to work their way out of the crisis at no cost to themselves.
Well,
it's an astonishing spectacle.
What was interesting was that it was Goldman Sachs and other American banks that helped the Greek government hide the true amount of their debt. Now there's a discussion, and Eric, I want you to comment on that. There's discussion in the United States amongst these very powerful banking forces, insurance forces, about how to cut back the social wage in the United States with teachers and Medicare and Medicaid and so on. Eric, what's the landscape and the political situation in Greece?
Well, the political landscape, as I said, is two-thirds of the parliament call themselves socialists and or communists, and they have, by and large, bought on to these cutbacks. So if socialists and communists accept it, we can imagine what the American political establishment in the United States will do. But the big problem is, how combative is the working class? In the United States, the labor movement has been declined close to 40, 50 years in the United States. Membership has plummeted, as opposed to Greece, where the labor movement encompasses many of the workers, plus the difference the United States from much of the rest of the world, and that is that much of Greece are employed by the government. And in the United States, that's not the case. But I think the political landscape, we'll wait to see what's going to go on. There have already been huge demonstrations in Portugal. Portugal was huge, and we'll see what happens. And certainly American workers will be looking there, but unfortunately the status of the American labor movement has not been one of looking to unify, be in solidarity with other labor movements throughout Europe. In fact, I haven't heard anything.
With each other in the United
States. I haven't heard anything, maybe Rick has, of the AFL-CIO saying anything in support of the Greek labor movement, seven general strikes. This is looting. They are looting Greece. Greece is now going to privatize the post office, the gas, the waterworks, the railway. They've already privatized the airlines. So the banks are really picking off pieces of Greece which should be, you know, a story for the rest of the working class throughout Western Europe and the United States, what they're interested in. They're interested in depressing the wages, the social wages, and whatever they can accumulate. So I made a list. The waterworks, even the casinos in Greece are going to be privatized, which aren't many. The post office, the rail. Part of the deal, this is great, is that France and German defense contractors are selling weapons to Greece. Greece is in debt because they're buying these arms from France and Germany, who are loaning the money, and Greece had asked, could we be let out of those contracts? And they won't let them out of the contracts to buy arms. So it's really a forcing on Greece and ultimately on the Greek working class to buy junk, just crap, to help pay off the loans for the wealthiest in the world. I think the landscape in the United States right now actually is kind of not very hopeful, because the working class labor movement hasn't stepped up at all, and the cutbacks are going to happen. They've already happened. The difference is the United States can provide a stimulus. It's not in the Eurozone, so it can change its currency. At this point, I wouldn't even say I'm that optimistic about the United States and the working class here.
But Rick, what dynamic for the disaster in Greece does the United States share? Is it conceivable that the same sort of disaster in Greece could happen in the United States and bring about the same kind of drastic cutbacks here that the Greek people are suffering?
Absolutely. The United States has done exactly what Greece has done. In order to solve the problems of a government that is afraid of raising the taxes, either on the employers or on the workers, enough to pay all of its costs. For example, give you the big ones, the cost of an extremely expensive set of wars in Afghanistan and Iraq that cost hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars. If you went to the American people and said, okay, we're fighting these wars, and therefore it'll cost each family $5,000 this year and $7,000 next year, you would have seen an opposition to the war 10 times stronger than the one we've seen, because right now this is a war paid for by the expedient of the government borrowing the money.
And paying private contractors, by and large, to fight it.
Absolutely. Mm. And now that we've had a great crisis for 2 years and the government has had to spend huge amounts of money to try desperately to bail us out of the worst of it, it has been borrowing that money, too, because it is politically too dangerous to tax it. And so we are accumulating enormous debts. So for the first time in my lifetime, rating agencies and foreign lenders are beginning to say openly that the United States is becoming risky. Not as risky as Greece. We're a bigger country. We have more resources. But nonetheless, we're also borrowing a whole hell of a lot more than Greece is.
You're talking about U.S. Treasury bonds no longer being rated AAA?
That's right. That has been discussed. It's actually been raised even by Moody's, one of the major rating companies in the United States, not as something happening now, but as something that is beginning to worry them, because they have simple formulas. How much are you borrowing relative to the wealth of your society? Uh-huh. And the United States is beginning to borrow on a scale we've never seen to bail out of a crisis which is just in its early stages now and costing the government a vast amount of money. That's why I said at the beginning, the Greek crisis is a foretaste of here. And you already have in Washington now a shift. Today's New York Times is full of stories about how the Obama administration is now less concerned about spending money for the stimulus and more worried about the deficit, that is, the accumulating debts of the United States, which every deficit adds to. Well, the logic then is, do something about that deficit. Do something about that debt. Well, there's only two things you can do.
Yeah.
Either you cut back spending on your social programs that your government runs and really discussing saving all that money and using it to pay off your debts. Or, and this is the other one, you raise taxes, because that'll give you the money to reduce your debt. So, for example, in Greece, where it is legendary that the top 10% of the people just don't pay any taxes, it becomes a really important question why a socialist government doesn't have a major program to tax wealth. And if you look at the memorandum in May that defines what the government is doing, It is doing almost nothing on the taxes. Everything is about cutting spending. But that's also a foretaste of the United States, because the political forces in this country are much stronger in that direction even than they are in Greece. So notice that the government is not talking about taxing wealth in the United States or taxing high income, but is also thinking that they can follow suit. If Greek society breaks with a strong labor movement and strong leftist parties, if they accept that the way out of the crisis is by making the mass of people poorer, then you can be very sure that other countries, including the United States, will be all the more likely to take that step too.
Eric, what's your thinking on that?
Well, it's really a explosive situation, because we've been talking about the socialists and left wing. With economic instability also breeds fears of the middle class and certain segments that turn to the right. And there's already been a rise of a openly fascist movement in Greece, and even to the point of marching in a state parade, an entire regiment of the Coast Guard chanted racist fascist slogans. Now, they've been disciplined, but the fact that they would feel they could openly do that. And the United States, we've seen the rise of the Tea Party, especially in the United States, if there is no strong reaction from the labor movement, from the sections of progressive sectors, civil rights movement, women's movement. The right wing continues to grow, continues to occupy the national media with the Tea Party, the rise of anti-immigration statutes in Arizona, the threats throughout the country, even upholding, as the Virginia governor did, the Confederacy. A candidate for senator questions the Civil Rights Bill of 1964. I think we're in real dangerous times, and we'll see that rise of the right wing.
What's so lamentable, at least from my point of view, and I'd like your reaction to this too, is the misdirection that was supplied by the Democratic administration led by Obama. So many people supported him, had hopes in him, campaigned for him, donated money to him. What I'm afraid of is that without an organization of our own that defends us, but continued reliance on what's described as the lesser of two evils, and I think people are going to say 2 years from now, when Obama wants to run again, maybe comes up against Liz Cheney, probably because Sarah Palin is too much of a lightweight, but they'll put, you know, the right wing will have a candidate up, and the argument's going to be the same. You got to support Obama again because he's better than the other person. And what I'm afraid of is what you've been describing, Eric, that in Greece there's this rise of the right wing, that it's beginning in this country too, and that we have absolutely no organization to defend ourselves.
Let me use a historical parallel. In 1933, at the depth of the last major collapse of capitalism in the United States, our then President Roosevelt went on the radio and said something like the following: we have 25% of our people unemployed, 2.5 times what we have now. This is intolerable. We can't let it go on. I have asked, begged, and pleaded the private sector to step up and hire people so we can get them back to work. The private sector cannot do so, refuses to do so, and claims it can't. All right, if the private sector can't do it, then we will do it from the public sector. Over the next 8 years, the federal government created 11 million jobs. If it did the same today, even though we have a much higher population, it would effectively almost wipe out the unemployment that we have. The amazing question, and it follows from what Eric points out, is that we have a president today in a terrible economic crisis. And not only is there no government program to hire people, it's not proposed, it's not defended. Our president isn't explaining that our own history has that as the thing we did the last time. The notion that all that could be done for solving unemployment is being done is a complete untruth. I'm trying to be as polite as I can. And it's remarkable that not only has the president not done it, but the labor movement, which has yet to call a major conference on unemployment that all people could come to manifest their concern, is also not pressing the president for a public employment program of the sort that we've had before. And I think it's a sign that the long-term historical significance of Obama's election may well have been what a number of European newspapers said at the time.
When you're going through a difficult time where the program of the ruling groups in a society are to put the cost of a crisis onto the backs of the working people, you need someone that the working people will trust, someone that the working people will have hope in, someone who can make the pain last longer because people will give him the benefit of the doubt. I think our trade unions are afraid of embarrassing Mr. Obama, and so they don't do anything. And so we sit looking at a resurgent right wing, but partly it's because the left, which is strong in the United States, a lot of people are very angry about what's going on, but they don't know how to move because with this president in these times, everybody doesn't want to upset what continues to be a hope that he will do something other than what he shows every day.
Well, what's really an irony, President Obama's election actually disoriented many of the people who would be leading protests, organizing conferences. So that while it was certainly a great achievement that a black man could be elected president, the fact is you look at who backed him, and it was Goldman Sachs. It was a lot of the big corporations in the hopes, as Rich says, of he could be the one who would appeal to the groups who would be most upset about the economy, the working class, blacks, Latinos, Asians. And by putting their hope in President Obama, it would slow down any kind of fight or fight back that they might start. So the problem really has been this disorientation of putting all our eggs in one basket, the electoral basket of electing Democrats, friends of labor, so-called, who then start cutbacks. You know, the right wing calling Obama a socialist is laughable. I think that labor, civil rights, other people are scared of that and feel that they cannot even propose anything that will sound mildly Keynesian, let alone socialist, because they'll be tarred with that brush by the right wing. And instead of looking the other way, that is organizing to fight against this. Greece is more than just an isolated example. It's really what's going to start happening in the United States.
It's understood in Europe, by the way, that what's happening in Greece is immediately relevant to them. And that's not just countries like Portugal and Spain. It's Italy, it's France, and in the end, it's even Germany and England and Ireland as well, because they all understand that this crisis comes out of the financial sector, comes out of the organization of capitalism, and that there's now an effort by the very forces that produced this crisis to emerge from it stronger than they went into it, and to put the cost and the burden of it all on the mass of people.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with economics professor Rick Wolf and National Lawyers Guild attorney Eric Poulos on the crisis in Greece and its ramifications for us here in the United States.
Here in the United States, the quintessential example is the following. Over the last 2 months, an immense lobbying effort was put forward by the largest banks in the United States to make sure that that bill coming out of the Congress any day now, the so-called financial regulation bill, that it has only those kinds of elements in it that will not hurt them, will not damage their bottom line beyond a very little bit. In other words, that they won't get regulated in any significant way. What Americans need to understand is the government that bailed those banks out
by handing them hundreds of billions of dollars is now being lobbied by the same banks using the money the government gave them, that is your money and mine, to make sure they don't get regulated. That is a spectacle that only a population with no courage at all would sit and take.
Well, here's a recurring theme that could be the basis of an American labor movement, progressive movement. When Papandreou took power, he said the government was shocked to find out what the real story was, that it had been hidden. The conservative government, conservative liberal Democrat, which just took power in England, said they were shocked what the economy was. It was totally hidden. All of this is behind closed doors, and I think that's one of the main things of the labor movement. The Americans can demand some transparency, because the bill, as Rick talked about, that's being talked about in Washington, the lobbyists, what happens there is totally hidden from us. And those books should be open immediately, before any talk of cutbacks, anything occurs. An independent public accounting should be done, controlled by the labor movement, by people who know, who can read through those ledgers and examine what is the real story, not the story as proposed by Goldman Sachs.
If we had our druthers and we could create our own organization, what would the demands of that organization be? The books, you say, Eric. That's a good start. What would you add to that, Rick?
I would focus on two things. First, every statistical study, whether you are a right-winger, left-winger, or somewhere in the middle, over the last 30 years in the United States, reaches the same conclusion. The top 1 and 2% of the wealthy people in the United States have seen their wealth explode over the last 30 years, and most of the rest of us have barely managed to stay even. That means the explosion of the financial world, the explosion of this deregulated capitalism that started with Reagan and goes all the way up to the present, it produced a tremendous growth in wealth of a tiny portion of our people. And along the way, it also developed the basis for one of the worst collapses of our economic system. Nothing would be fairer than the following. Those who made out like bandits, and I choose the word carefully, over the last 30 years, ought to be made to pay the lion's share of the cost of cleaning up the economic mess their happy three decades produced. And so the first thing a proper administration should do is say, we are going to go where the wealth grew the fastest and take from them a portion of what they grew as their wealth to deal with the mess they've made. That would be fair, that would be reasonable, and that could translate into a tremendous increase in the tax revenue of the government by taxing that top 1 and 2%, which is long overdue anyway, and is now, it's almost criminal not to do it. That's the first thing. The second thing is to say, look, so long as private enterprises are organized such that the vast majority of people come to work 9 to 5, Monday to Friday, do their job and go home, and all the decisions are made, as Eric said, behind closed doors by something called a board of directors, 15 to 20 people, who are elected by and responsible to the major shareholders of a company, usually another group of 15 to 20 people. That's outrageous. That's going to produce economic decisions, what to produce, how to produce, where to produce, what to do with the profits that serve those small groups of people and those dependent on them, shareholders and so on. That shouldn't be the way we organize an economy. It should be built from the ground up to serve the vast majority. If democracy means anything, it ought to begin in the place we spend most of our adult lives, where we work, where the decisions about what is done is made by the majority of people there, and that's the workers who ought to operate and own the enterprises themselves. We have to face that question, because if we don't, all the rest of what we do is simply playing around the edges and not dealing with the fundamental problem.
Well, I agree with everything Rick said. It's time to have public ownership of all the means of what we produce, what we make, what we mine, what we sell, what we farm. Trusting British Petroleum to clean up its own mess has shown that there's a myth that Americans are told about private business is more efficient? It's a myth, like Greek myths. It's a myth. I bet the workers at British Petroleum could have done a much better job, and they haven't even paid attention, the 11 workers they killed. So what we need is to have workers' control of that. If private corporations want government money to bail them out, we take them over. We'll run it. If there are going to be layoffs, we cut the work week. Work 4 days instead of 5 days, but the workers get the same pay as 5 days, but create more jobs that way. Have a massive public works program, as Rick talked about, which has been done in American history. It's not anything unusual and can be done. But for that, you really need the political will. And the question is, where will that come from and how will that be done?
And I think we have to face, as Michael says, the two major parties have shown themselves in good times and now in bad times, absolutely unable, unwilling to ask any of the basic questions about how this economy works. They always come too little, too late. The stunning incapacity to deal with this catastrophe in the Gulf of Mexico is just a wonderful example of their failures across the board. They didn't handle our financial system very well, so we have a terrible crisis. They didn't handle the unemployment situation, so we have 20 million people sitting around with either no work or much less work than they need or want. The level of failure is stunning, and the two political parties act like there's nothing to worry about. Until there's a new and different political organization and mobilization of people, we're not going to see any more responsiveness from these political parties than we have already seen.
Thank you, Rick Wolf. Eric, give us the last word.
Well, this is really the time, the most appropriate time with British Petroleum, with the failure of AIG, to talk about socialism in the United States and not to mention the rest of the world. But it really is shown how much capitalism has failed, how much we cannot rely on them for simple, elementary things like cleaning our waters. And the old albatross that used to be the police states like the Soviet Union that got associated with socialism don't exist anymore. We can now start clean and talk about socialism as a system that will implement measures so we can all live better and we don't have to go through layoffs, austerity, selling off of public industries and things like that.
Eric Poulos, Rick Wolf, thank you very much for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you very much for having us.
Thank you, Michael.
Attorney and radio host Jim Lafferty joins us today to give us updates on the upcoming anti-war conference in July in Albany, New York, and the ongoing immigration policy conflicts in Arizona, where he has recently visited. We will also get more information on attorney Peter Erlander's condition in Rwanda. As listeners may know, former National Lawyers Guild president and professor Peter Erlander was arrested several weeks ago by the Rwandan police for allegedly denying the country's 1994 genocide. He is currently imprisoned in Rwanda, and very little information about his situation or his health is allowed to get out. Jim Lafferty, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Michael. Good to talk to you.
Well, it's nice to have you back. You know, I don't know that we ever told our audience that it was your program, the Lawyers Guild show in L.A. on KPFK, which is our sister Pacifica station out there, that was the inspiration for me and Heidi and Michael to do a similar kind of lawyer show here in New York City. And moreover, you've been a guest several times, and you've had some of our shows on your show.
It's very incestuous. Well, and your show is just extraordinary.
Thank you. Jim, we wanted to talk to you about several things today, things that you've been right in the middle of. And let me start by asking you what the situation is with the upcoming United National Anti-War Conference, which is going to be held here in Albany in July. What was it that brought us to the point where we're having this conference in July?
Well, I think there's been a certain ebb in the anti-war movement in terms of how it's manifested itself in the streets. I don't think there's any doubt about that. And yet the sentiment in the country against the war, especially as the war in Afghanistan continues to spread, the death toll on both sides mount. Obama's spread the war now to Pakistan as well. The anti-war forces in this country, recognizing the growing sentiment against the war, feel an obligation to draw as many of the forces in the anti-war movement together as they possibly can, and this conference is broadly supported. It's got, I think, close to, if not more now, than 24 co-sponsors. It was originally undertaken by the National Assembly, which is one of the anti-war coalitions. But it's now got, as I say, a couple of dozen co-sponsors that
like
kind of cover the waterfront. Well, you've got Iraqi Vets Against the War. You've got Military Families Against the War. You've got U.S. Labor Against the War. You've got Code Pink, Raging Grannies. I mean, you name it, and they're there. The International Action Coalition is there, and so forth. We're expecting a good-sized turnout. Hundreds of people will be gathering in Albany to help revitalize the movement, get that sentiment that we know is against the war back into the streets where it could be most effective. We hope your listeners, who are close to Albany in many cases, will want to register and come to the conference. It's July 23rd and 24th in Albany. They go to the United National Anti-War Conference.org or UNAC.org, and it talks about the who's speaking, the various workshops, the plenaries. This is an open and democratic conference. Everybody that comes gets a vote. There'll be vigorous debate, and at the end of it, we expect there'll be a call to action or proposals for joint actions that these various groups can carry on in the months and period ahead in order to bring the kind of pressure again on the Obama administration, who is, of course, waging now a wider war than Bush did, to finally get us out of that mess.
Well, Jim Lafferty, you and I will be at the conference in July in Albany. We hope that our listeners will be able to make it up to Albany and participate in it. Let me switch to something closer to home, and that's the war on immigrants that's going on in Arizona. I know you went from Los Angeles over to Arizona to provide some help just last month. I don't understand why they would pass such a law in Arizona. Talk about what they did and what we can do about it.
Well, what, of course, is happening in Arizona is that the legislature has passed a law which is blatantly racial. It basically gives the police forces in Arizona the right to stop anyone for any apparent, oh, maybe they've got a taillight out, or maybe they crossed the street when the light was red and hadn't turned green yet. It gives the police the right to then interrogate that person, make them prove that they're a citizen of the United States or in this country legally. Otherwise, they on a bus and they can be deported. Even the Obama administration, which is so timid on this whole question of immigration reform, has spoken out against the law. Attorney generals have spoken out against the law. Major police chiefs in Arizona have spoken out against the law because they say it's going to make Arizona less safe because people that are in the country that aren't documented are going to be unwilling to talk to the police, unwilling to report crimes, unwilling to be witnesses in crimes. I suppose it comes in that long history in our country of when there is an economic downturn, when there is great confusion among the people, when there is great reaction among the people. You need a scapegoat. So, of course, who's a good scapegoat? Well, of course, it's the immigrants. And I think that's what's happening here again. There are at least 10 other states that I know of that are considering the same kind of legislation. There are, on the other hand, there have been a number of cities, including Los Angeles and other major cities here in California and around the country, that have now voted to boycott Arizona and to indicate that they will not do any business with Arizona until this law is overturned. Just a week or so ago, there were 80 or more thousand people in Arizona that came from all over the country to protest the law. We've had numerous arrests, CD arrests here in Los Angeles, that myself and the National Lawyers Guild have been defending, where you have college students and others engaging in peaceful civil disobedience actions under the theme that we are all Arizona, because what can happen in Arizona, of course, as I said, is already bubbling up in other states around the country. And so you have people all over the country, and especially in places like Southern California, where there is a huge immigrant population, stepping up in acts of solidarity with our sisters and brothers in Arizona, engaging in these peaceful protests. And they've got a great deal of attention here. And as I say, our own city council here has responded wonderfully well by calling for a boycott.
We're speaking with Attorney Jim Lafferty, one of the leaders of the National Lawyers Guild and the head of the chapter out in Los Angeles, and the host of the Los Angeles show, the Lawyers Guild show. Jim, it's so true that the Mexican Americans are scapegoated on this. They're getting politically conscious and politically active. The May Day demonstrations of a couple years ago were just amazing.
Just so, because I think it got so little attention, the May Day demonstration here again this year had well over 250,000 people at it, according even to the L.A. police.
That was a non-event in the news media here in New York. They're really showing the way for other sectors of the population to get mobilized.
Well, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that. There was a wonderful article here some time ago about the fact that not only are the immigrants cleaning our hospital beds and taking care of our children and mowing our lawns and driving our buses and picking up our garbage, they're now exercising our First Amendment rights for us. It's the immigrants who bravely and often have much to lose because many of them are here in an undocumented fashion, who nevertheless are the first to take to the streets to speak up on behalf of rights.
You know, and the irony is that particularly since Clinton and NAFTA, when all the jobs, promised jobs, never materialized and, in fact, were lost, and more Mexicans were impoverished and had to come north looking for work, and now you get this reaction.
Well, you do, and of course, as our own economy has suffered, you've got a lot of those folks going home. If there's no work here, they don't come here because they'd rather live here than in their homeland. They come here out of the desperation, as you say, from the financial problems in their own countries. In the case of Mexico, problems that are not only Mexico's making, but the U.S. corporate America's making as well, because our corporations, of course, have exploited that country for generations.
What events are planned now in reaction to that Arizona law? Do you think there's a chance to get it overthrown in the court system, or is it going to take action in the streets, or both?
Well, I think it's both. You're right, and I'm glad you mentioned the court system. There are lawsuits that have already been filed. A number of lawsuits have already been filed. The Mexican American Bar Association, the ACLU, and Holder, the Attorney General of the United States, keeps talking about the possibility of bringing a lawsuit. He ought to get on the stick and do it. Every constitutional lawyer, every lawyer for that matter that I've talked to, including some who are rather conservative, agree that the law is unconstitutional on its face.
For what reason?
Because it's essentially allowing the police for the reason of how someone looks. For example, some of the members of the state legislature in Arizona have pointed out that they are married to people, men or women, who are legally in this country, but who in fact are Spanish, of Spanish origin, and therefore they're going to be stopped by the police.
Just because their skin color is darker than
yeah.
someone else's.
Yes, exactly right. And so the harassment that's going to come about as a result of that. What if that person doesn't have the proper identification on them when they happen to leave the house that morning for a walk? One of the state legislators in Arizona made that point. His wife, who is Mexican-American, often goes out in the morning for a walk. What happens if police think she's loitering, and the next thing you know, she's on a bus because she can't prove who she is?
I mean, you know, that happened to me after 9/11 when the Army was occupying my neighborhood in Lower Manhattan, and I walked out of the house forgetting to bring my ID, and when I came back to my neighborhood to get back to my apartment, I couldn't get in. And I'm thinking, you know, this is the beginning of a police state. And now 9 years later, they're actually doing this in Arizona.
They're actually doing this. That, you know, it reminds one of identity cards. It reminds one of apartheid South Africa. It reminds one of all of the kinds of things that we don't like to associate with this country. But sadly, more and more, we have to recognize are happening in this country.
Let me now turn our attention to something close to home here in New York. I was on the demonstration in his support. Our friend and colleague and comrade Peter Erlander is in a jail in Rwanda, has some health problems as well. He hasn't been able to establish contact with his attorney or his family. We're awfully worried about him. He went over there to defend a criminal indictee who was also running for president, and he himself wound up in jail charged with breaking Rwanda law. Mm-hmm. Tell us about what happened to Peter and what we can do about it.
Well, yes. First of all, the law that he supposedly has broken is so draconian, it may be hard for your listeners to get their mind around it. There was, of course, genocide and genocidal wars, civil wars in Rwanda. Rwanda now has a law that makes it illegal to subscribe to, quote-unquote, genocidal ideology. And that law is defined in such a way that if you're an attorney and you're defending someone who is accused of genocide, then you have violated that part of the law which says you cannot, therefore, support genocidal ideology. Therefore, if you're a lawyer, as Peter Erlander is, who has been working off and on in Rwanda for years in these criminal trials, good trials, trials that should take place, you're subject to arrest yourself if you try to defend someone. The woman that Peter Erlander is defending happens to be the leading candidate to depose the current president of Rwanda. And Peter's claim is, and I've seen some of the evidence, that she herself was not guilty of any genocide, that in fact the current government is corrupt and is up to its eyeballs in past genocidal acts. And one of the things that Peter has been very good at doing in these trials is making sure that guilt lies where it should lie and not with innocent people, and in the process has disclosed some of the perfidy and the conspiracy on the part of Western nations in that Rwandan genocide of some time ago. There are a team of lawyers in Rwanda, all of whom are facing the same fate of Peter. Peter has been very outspoken as an American lawyer with a long history of standing up for human rights and standing up for decency and the rule of law. It's not surprising, therefore, I suppose, that the Rwandan government has seen him as a thorn in their side. They've used this draconian law to put him in jail. You're right, quite right. His health is not good at all. He has very, very high blood pressure problems. He's not being able to get all of his medicine. He suffers from some other illnesses as well. One piece of good news I can correct you on, though, Mike, that his lawyers now there have been able to make contact with him. They have been able to talk to him. But the matter is still quite dire. As a result of a great deal of pressure, the U.S. State Department, which initially took the position that this was, quote-unquote, a local matter, has now made sure that the embassy officials there see Peter regularly and have called for Peter's release on humanitarian grounds. Peter's wife and daughter, Sarah Erlander, the daughter is also an attorney, and others are working very hard on how we're going to free Peter. But what people can do, of course, is to contact their own legislators, their own members of Congress, especially though they can make calls to the number of the Rwandan embassy and very nicely say, look, this is wrong. You must free this man. The whole world is watching what you're doing here. You're simply exacerbating your bad reputation coming out of the genocidal wars by keeping this human rights lawyer in prison under these ridiculous charges. He was recently denied bail. That's of great concern to us. He's had to be hospitalized a couple of times. This is a situation where I would hope the listeners of BAI, and I know like our station here, are in the main progressive people who believe in upholding the rule of law and of human rights, would consider this a brother, just as you and I do, and one of the great American lawyers who is now in grave jeopardy in Rwanda for doing what we would always hope members of the bar would do, and I would urge them to call the State Department, call the Rwandan embassy, and demand the release of Peter Erlander.
You can call Washington. The ambassador is at 202-232-2882. That's the Rwandan ambassador, James Kimonyo, in Washington. Give him a call. I'm sure he'll like to hear from us. 202-232-2882. Give him a call and tell him to free Peter Erlander. Well, Jim Lafferty, it's been very, very good to have you on Law and Disorder once again. Thank you so much. Stay in touch, and we'll get you back before
the
summer's end.
Michael, it's always a pleasure to be on your show, as you know, and I look forward to seeing you soon.
Great, Jim. Take it easy.
Bye-bye.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.